Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member, FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 31st of January, these are our main stories. As the coronavirus outbreak continues to spread beyond China, the World Health Organization declares it a global health emergency. The Palestinian Prime Minister has told the BBC that if Israel annexes any part of the occupied West Bank, all agreements between the two sides will end. Interpol has launched a campaign against the Italian-based 'Ndrangheta, which it describes as the world's most powerful criminal organisation. Also in this podcast...
With a wingspan of around 3 metres, the albatross can travel huge distances and they're built to soar.
But could they become flying spies tracking illegal fishing boats? The World Health Organization has declared that the coronavirus outbreak is now a global health emergency. The illness, which has killed 170 people in China, has now spread to 18 other countries. The head of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, explained the reasoning behind the move.
The main reason for this declaration is not because of what is happening in China, but because of what is happening in other countries. Our greatest concern is the potential for the virus to spread to countries with weaker health systems and which are ill prepared to deal with it.
Mr. Adhanom Ghebreyesus congratulated Beijing on what he called the extraordinary measures it had taken so far.
The Chinese government is to be congratulated for the extraordinary measures it has taken to contain the outbreak. Despite the severe social and economic impact those measures are having on the Chinese people, we would have seen many more cases outside China by now, and probably deaths, if it were not for the government's efforts and the progress they have made to protect their own people and the people of the world.
Tim Franks spoke to Jeremy Kanindike, a senior policy fellow at the Centre for Global Development. He's also a member of an independent body which oversees the WHO's Health Emergencies Programme.
Well, I think at this point it's clearly the right call. When they last looked at this issue just last week, the numbers were much lower and the information at the time looked much more ambiguous. And it was debatable at that time, but it was a close call. I don't think it's a close call any longer, and I think they made the right decision.
Despite the fact that it's only 1% of cases that are outside China's borders.
Yes, because we've seen within China's borders that the potential for human-to-human spread is very, very high indeed. And I think that wasn't so clear a week ago. You know, just a week to 10 days ago, there was still a lot of speculation that this might be mainly about animal-to-human transmission. I think now it's very clear that it's quite transmissible amongst humans. And that really changes the calculus in terms of the global risk. As Dr. Tedros, I think, rightly said, the risks, especially to underdeveloped countries with weak health systems, could be quite significant. So it's time to start readying now.
And in terms of the difference that it will make around the world, what can you point to? I mean, he did, yes, absolutely talk about trying to support those countries, particularly with weaker health systems. But this declaration, what does it substantively change?
Well, it does a few things. First, and I think very importantly, it's got a very important signaling effect. You know, this is a wake-up call to the world that this is now not just a China problem or a regional problem, it's a global problem. And by definition, when this declaration is made, that's the implication. And so it's a signal to countries around the world that they need to begin gearing up. It's also a signal to countries like the U.S., like the U.K., wealthier countries that support global health efforts to begin investing in and supporting preparedness in countries that are vulnerable. So that signaling effect, that wake-up call that it provides, is one very important thing. But then also it opens up some expanded and enhanced authorities for WHO. So it will require enhanced reporting cases and case information to WHO. It will also authorize WHO to provide non-binding but highly influential guidance to countries around the world about how they can protect themselves and what they should, but also what they should not do. And I thought Dr. Tedros's comments today recommending against travel and trade bans were particularly important in that respect.
It was very striking, that. And I just wonder whether you got the sense from him. I mean, clearly he was being very diplomatic, but whether he felt that perhaps there's been too much caution in terms of airlines, for example, saying we're no longer going to fly.
This sort of disease, a disease that can spread through airborne transmission, is extremely difficult to fully contain when it's gotten to the scale it's gotten to in China. And so I think, you know, really we need to begin envisioning this as a shift from containment to perhaps one more of mitigation. With travel and trade restrictions, the sort that are being discussed now, often the second order impacts of those can be more damaging than the level of protection they actually provide against the virus. And the consensus in the public health community is generally those sorts of measures at best delay but do not really contain the spread of the disease.
Jeremy Kleindike, a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development. The Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya says Israel has been warned that if it annexes any part of the occupied West Bank, all agreements between the two sides will be terminated. Mr. Shataya told the BBC this would include economic and political deals struck in the past, as well as agreements on security cooperation. Under President Trump's Israeli-Palestinian peace plan, which was unveiled on Tuesday, Israel will be free to annex all the settlements it's built in the West Bank. Speaking to BBC correspondent Orla Guerin in Ramallah, Mr. Shataya denied that the Palestinians had once again missed an opportunity by unequivocally rejecting this latest plan.
If we accepted the deal, we could have been good guys. Simply because we are stick to our national interest, we are not good guys anymore. If that is the criteria for who is good and who is bad, we prefer to be very bad sticking to aspirations of our people and our legitimate right in an independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. Let them call us whatever they want.
But did you make a strategic mistake in boycotting the American administration since December 2017? That basically meant you had no voice at the table. You were not part of the negotiations.
It was not we who did boycott the United States. United States has taken every measure to really push us away from the negotiating table.
Surely you must have expected the Arab world to come out clearly on your side, which it has not done. It has not rejected this plan.
We can understand the political sensitivity for some Arab countries. Obviously, I think it's really the moment of being decisive. People who are not with us, they will find themselves with the other side. And I think that's unusual for Arab countries.
But doesn't it already look like Arab countries have picked a side and it's not yours? We have Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Qatar, UAE. We have Bahrain and Oman who were actually present in the White House when this document was launched.
Yes, but you see, we received phone calls, frankly, from Arab countries who told us that having our ambassador present at the press conference does not mean that we support the plan. So it's just maybe a courtesy visit. People were listening. We have to really differentiate between when it comes to the moment of truth. I don't really think that Arab countries will sell out Palestinians.
Can I ask you about the Palestinian reaction? I have seen far bigger demonstrations here in years gone by. I mean, it seems like you've lost the support of your own people.
On the contrary, we did not call for one single rally to be for everybody together in Ramallah just to show for the media. No. It was in Jenin, in Qalqili, in Nablus, in Tul Karim, in Jericho, here in Ramallah, in Jerusalem, Beit Lahem, Hebron, everywhere, and Gaza.
But these protests were small. They were not on the scale that we have seen here in the past.
I think this has to do with as I told you, that the decision was each community should express its own reaction in their own zone. Look what happened in Gaza just a month ago. 500,000 or more Palestinians, they were celebrating the launching of the Fatah revolution and so on.
Exactly, but you couldn't get 500,000 out on the streets this week.
They're working on it. They didn't finish yet in Gaza.
Is the Palestinian Authority going to survive this?
We did survive many things before. I'm pretty sure that this is not a death of our political dream. I will tell you frankly, yesterday our president sent a letter to Mr. Netanyahu telling him if you implement any measure that has to do with annexation of any part of the Palestinian territory, that's the end of all agreements that we have signed with you, including security agreement, economic agreement, political agreement.
But we have heard these threats to end security cooperation so many times in the past, and it's never happened.
That's true. But now the Palestinian leadership has decided that it is on the desk of the president for implementation. He decides when and how to do it.
So if the Israelis make a move with this agreement, you will end security cooperation?
For sure.
The Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammed Shataya, speaking to the BBC's Orla Guerin. Interpol has launched a campaign against the Ndrangheta, which it calls the most extensive and powerful criminal organization in the world. The agency said the gang had built its strength mainly on drug trafficking, corruption, and the diversion of public funds through fraud and rigged public contracts. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
It's the world's biggest gang, but many haven't heard of it. From its origins in the Calabria region of southern Italy, the Ndrangheta graduated to kidnapping and then trafficking Colombian cocaine. Interpol says it now operates in 32 countries, more than half of them in Europe. Historically, it has been bloody. A clan war saw six men shot dead outside a restaurant in the German city of Duisburg in 2007. Interpol says these days it uses sophisticated money laundering and front companies to control public contracts, driving honest competitors out of business, generally without violence or intimidation.
Mike Sanders. Just 1 hour before midnight today, London time, the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. Brexit will have been activated. Britain's formal departure from the so-called Club of Europe will then be followed by months of intensive negotiations about how the country's extremely close relationship with the EU should be reconstructed, covering trade, migration, security and many other key areas. But after Brexit, is there any chance that the process could be reversed in the future? The former European Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker, didn't rule it out.
If Britain, at some juncture, would present itself or herself at the door of the European Union, who would be the one who would keep this door closed? It's better for Britain and for the European Union to have Britain with us than to have Britain beside us.
But in the present, what's going to happen to the 300,000 British people, many of them retired, who live in Spain? A lot of them appear either not to know what their rights will be or are confused about their status, as our Europe correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
On Spain's Costa Blanca, the sun is shining, the sky is blue, and at the Emerald Isle restaurant, the tables around the swimming pool are packed.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. It's lovely to be here with you. My name is Sandy. I know some familiar faces. It's lovely to be here.
The crowd are all British. Most live here in Orihuela or have holiday homes where they spend months at a time.
Everything you dream of.
As they bask in the balmy temperatures, beers in hand, Brexit is on a lot of minds. David whips out his blue European health card.
Well, my concern is the health side of things, you know. At the moment, this is valid. After Friday, what's going to happen with that?
And Eileen is worried about her pension.
Well, my concern is the pension. Will it be index-linked? If I came as Spanish resident, I don't know.
David and Eileen should be fine. Under the exit deal, if you're retired and living in an EU country, you will still get healthcare and an uprated pension. The only condition, you must register your residence in Spain before the end of 2020. Ian, who visits from the UK, staying in his holiday home for 6 months each winter, is concerned whether there will be limits on his stays in future.
You've got 90 days, you go back to the UK, and then you come back again for another 90 days. But you can't do 180 days in one go. I don't know. I'm just waiting to see what's going to happen, you know.
And he may be right. From 2021, UK citizens will still be able to travel freely on holidays to Europe, but each visit may have a time limit, perhaps 90 days. It's part of what has to be negotiated with the EU, what will replace current free movement rules. And the worries extend far beyond the seaside cafes in Orihuela. 300,000 UK passport holders are resident in Spain. One-third are pensioners, but two-thirds are not, and will lose rights they now enjoy.
Hello. Hi, Isabel. How are you?
Camilla Hillier-Fry has been in Spain for 30 years. She lives and works in Madrid. Her daughter Isabel was born here and is now at a Spanish university. The exit deal will not preserve their right to move freely to work or study in other EU countries from next year. So both have decided to take up Spanish citizenship.
I think it's sad for people like myself, who we've made our lives here. And we still feel British in a lot of ways. But what breaks my heart is the situation of young people. It's not just my children. There's another 12,000 British children who've been born in Spain and that have British citizenship. And that's a lot of people to forget.
But others haven't been here long enough to be eligible for a Spanish passport, like Matt Davis, who believes Brexit will be a moment that constricts his choices.
I'm certainly not going to be celebrating it, crying into my beer, perhaps, but...
Matt came to Spain looking for work. He's ended up with a job, a wife who's American, and a corgi puppy called Humphrey, playing on the sofa of their flat in Madrid. Matt can stay and work in Spain. However, after this year, faces losing his right to move freely to live or work in another European country. He's worried that the way the UK chooses to treat EU citizens in future will rebound on people like him.
The UK government is not going to allow European citizens to move to the UK so easily, or even like limit the amount of time they're allowed to live there. Well, then the same thing is going to happen to Brits, or something very similar.
What upsets him most, he says, is that others won't have the chances he's had.
It's been an amazing experience, really very life-enriching, and, yeah, kind of feel sad that people are not going to be able to, perhaps not going to have that opportunity in the future.
Matt, a British man living in Madrid, ending that report by Damien Grammaticus. On the BBC News website, there's a remarkable image, actually a set of moving images of the surface of the sun. It looks a bit like the cracked, weathered bark of a tree in a brownish-yellow colour. But play the short video and the surface appears almost like bubbling grilled cheese, flexing and convulsing. The images were taken by a powerful new telescope on top of a volcano in Hawaii. It's part of a project running alongside a new Solar Orbiter Space Observatory, which is being launched next week from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Tim Franks spoke to one of the lead scientists involved, Professor Chris Owen from the Mullard Space Science Laboratory at University College London, and asked him for more information about these images.
This is plasma, which is the sort of the outer surface of the sun, charged particles, which is bubbling up and welling up, rather like you'd see things welling up if you looked at a pan of boiling water or something like that. So really the holy grail is to understand, by looking at the sun, what is going on, how the magnetic field interacts with the charged particles that make up the upper layers of the corona, and how that boils off into space, creates something that we call the solar wind, which is the direct connection with the Earth. The most obvious thing there is, when the solar wind hits the Earth, it rattles our magnetic field and causes things like the aurora.
So we've got this remarkable level of detail, it seems, from this Yes. particular telescope. What's the project that you're involved in?
So I am what's known as a principal investigator on one of 10 instruments that are going to be launched next weekend on a mission called Solar Orbiter. Solar Orbiter has very much common goals with the Deakist telescope, and in fact we will be taking images that are very similar to what Deakist is getting. The difference here is that these telescopes They're rather smaller, and they will be taken in to the inner heliosphere, so the mission goes inside the orbit of Mercury. The images that you see here from DKIST are very high resolution, but they have some of the limitations that you get from observing from Earth, like sometimes it's cloudy and you can't see the sun. So we will go with Solar Orbiter and take a set of telescopes with complementary capability, but we will also be taking a set of instruments, of which mine is one, that we sniff the solar wind that's coming away from all that activity that you see, all that boiling activity that you see in those DKIST images.
And what are you looking for? What are you sniffing for?
We're looking for the link. In some sense, in the way that you might diagnose your car by sticking an analyzer up its exhaust pipe and sniff the gases that are coming out of your car and say, OK, now I know what's going wrong with my car. OK, nothing's going wrong with the sun. But the point is that we will be able to, with our images, we look at the activity, we look at these loops and how they evolve in time, how the magnetic field gets wound up, how they erupt. But then we have a set of measurements that are, you know, from the spacecraft sitting above that eruption, where we measure the magnetic field that's been thrown out from the sun along with all the particles that come with that, that carry that magnetic field. And in particular, the instrument that I've led is a particle detector. So we have three sensors, one that measures the electrons, one that measures the protons, that's the negative and the positive charge particles, and then one that measures all the sort of the exotic particles that the sun produces. And those kind of give you a fingerprint of the processes that are going on in the same way that, going back to the analogy of something boiling, you know, you'd smell it and say, that's tomato soup, right? And so you're doing that with a kind of, you know, robot nose to pick up the composition of the solar wind and relate that to the processes that created that solar wind.
Right. And in terms, I mean, clearly these are things that are interesting and valuable in their own right, trying to understand how our star operates.
For sure.
In terms, when you talk about solar wind, I mean, you mentioned it just at the start of the interview, this is something which we are aware of can affect life on Earth, or at least life in terms of things like satellites, which we depend on. Tell me why it matters, understanding the sun's behaviour in those terms.
I think what you're referring to is a relatively new area called space weather. As society gets more and more technological and we have smaller electronics, they are more and more susceptible to the kind of effects that happen in space, the radiation particles, strong fields. And, you know, it only takes one little chip to be damaged by one tiny charged particle to lose a satellite that somebody may have invested €1 billion, pounds, whatever in. I mean, it has lots of other effects. You know, it can affect astronaut health. If you're flying over the poles, you know, you get a radiation dose if you're unfortunate enough to be flying when one of these big solar events goes off. So there are many, many different effects that come under space weather. And ultimately, you'd like to know about that and be able to predict it.
Professor Chris Owen from the Mullard Space Science Laboratory at University College London. And check out the amazing images on the BBC website. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
The Compass is the podcast from the BBC World Service that really gets under the skin of a story.
I can tell you what I believe is not the truth, and you know it's not the truth, and now get away with it. So, I will tell a lie.
With series that take an in-depth look at how the world today really works.
Sometimes I think that we are moving into the right direction and change is happening. And then I realize that 9 to 10 women get killed every day in this country, so I don't feel we're moving forward at all.
And why things are the way they are.
I have been socialized to be a soldier, to be someone aggressive and even to dominate, especially women or other people. So I have this kind of fear that what if I one day become a violent person?
The Compass Podcast from the BBC World Service.
She shamed the politicians into taking an interest in it.
Search for The Compass wherever you get your podcasts.
And let's return once again to the Global News podcast. Dozens of heavily armed men have attacked an indigenous community in northern Nicaragua, killing at least 6 people and kidnapping another 10. The attack on the Mayangna group took place in a protected nature reserve. Our America's editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
A Nicaraguan environmentalist said that as many as 80 men took part in the invasion of the indigenous lands. They set houses on fire, shot at those who tried to fight back, and abducted 10 members of the Mayagna community. The Bosawas Biosphere Reserve, where the attack took place, is in the second largest rainforest of the Americas after the Amazon. It has been the focus of land disputes between indigenous people and cattle farmers. A Mayagna community leader, Gustavo Lino, has accused the Nicaraguan government of doing nothing while his community is gradually exterminated.
Leonardo Rocha. The majestic albatross is one of the largest flying birds. They cover thousands of kilometres over the oceans in a single trip. But could they become flying spies tracking illegal fishing boats? Katie Heil has more.
With a wingspan of around 3 metres, the albatross can travel huge distances and they're built to soar. Researchers in France and the UK have now found that by fitting more than 200 of the seabirds with radar detectors or loggers on their backs, they can pick up signals from illegal fishing boats. Samantha Patrick is a senior lecturer in marine biology at the University of Liverpool and took part in the study.
So what these loggers do is when they're equipped onto the back of an albatross, they're able to detect the radar of boats, and this means that they're able to detect both legal fishing boats but also illegal fishing boats as well. And it gives us a much better idea of how many boats there are and whether these are registered boats or unregistered ones.
Thanks to the data picked up by the albatross patrols, the researchers found that 1/5 of boats in French waters could be fishing illegally. And that figure is even higher in the southern Indian Ocean, where almost 1/3 of boats are not broadcasting their whereabouts. But do these loggers cause any harm to the albatross?
The loggers we put on are about 45 grams. So they're a really tiny proportion of the bird's body weight. So the birds have the loggers taped onto their back. So we use a really sticky duct tape. And they're taped onto the back of the bird on their feathers. And what that means is that the bird can go to sea, collect the data for us, and then when it returns to the nest, we're able to just untape the logger and it doesn't cause the birds any harm.
Of course, the albatross can't fly everywhere. So to cover the parts of the ocean these birds don't go, researchers plan to bring in other species into their studies. One day, perhaps all the world's waters could be monitored from a bird's eye view.
Katie Heil reporting. The world governing body for athletics is set to tighten regulations on high-tech running shoes, with an announcement expected on Friday. It's understood the review panel won't impose a blanket ban on Nike's controversial Vaporfly range, with their deep soles, their patented extra springy foam and embedded carbon plate. The running shoes are helping athletes break records, as our sport editor Dan Roan explains.
They are the shoes that have revolutionised distance running. Nike's controversial Vaporfly range has been a game changer since its release in 2016. Last year, modified versions were used by the legendary Eliud Kipchoge when he became the first athlete to complete a marathon in less than 2 hours, and his fellow Kenyan Brigid Kosgei, who smashed the women's world record over the same distance a day later. But how much were their feet down to the footwear? The sports rules say shoes must not provide an unfair advantage. But some critics, like British Olympian Mara Yamauchi, who was sponsored by a rival shoe firm, now want World Athletics to step in and issue a ban.
What we're getting into now is not who's the best athlete, who's got the best shoes on. It's hard to see how anybody not wearing Vaporflies in the Tokyo Olympics is going to win medals.
The 5 fastest marathons ever have all been achieved by runners wearing types of Vaporfly in the last 2 years. So what's the secret? Dr. Tom Allen, a senior lecturer in mechanical engineering at the Manchester Metropolitan University's Institute of Sport, explained the science hidden inside the shoe.
One of the key features of this shoe is the foam. So it's particularly light. That thick foam can deform a lot, store lots of energy, and then return lots of energy as well. The other key feature is this full-length carbon plate. It allows the athlete to have greater leverage and also stiffens the front of the shoe, allows them to run more efficiently. The claim is that your running economy can increase by around 4%.
With Vaporflies popular among amateur runners despite the £240 price tag, there's unlikely to be a blanket ban. But some customised versions may exceed new temporary restrictions. Nike says it respects the rules and its shoes do not return more energy than the runner uses. Technology in sport's nothing new, of course, but some fear running is being distorted. And in the pursuit of fairness, athletics rules must now catch up and fast.
Our sport editor, Dan Roan. Archaeologists have put 16 ancient Egyptian tombs on display. They were discovered at a site in the Minya region south of Cairo. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston has the story.
The tombs were the burial places of high priests and senior officials who lived 3,000 years ago. They contained 20 stone coffins, including one dedicated to the sky god, Horus. 10,000 figurines were found in the graves, along with hundreds of amulets, which would have been worn to ward off evil and bring good fortune. Some were made of pure gold. Also unearthed were limestone jars that would have been used to store the entrails of the mummified dead.
Alan Johnston. Now back to our main news. The World Health Organization has declared the coronavirus outbreak is a global health emergency. The illness, which has killed 170 people in China, has spread to 18 other countries. In China itself... That's the sound of a hospital under construction, one of two due to be completed in just a week in Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak. The city and Hubei, the province in which it's situated, is in lockdown. That's around 60 million people confined to their homes. Our China media analyst Kerry Allen told us how some of these people are keeping boredom at bay.
TV is not showing a lot. It's providing extra TV programming on the coronavirus. So people are just trying to read, find things to do. And the majority of people are actually turning to a live stream that they can access via their mobile phone or via their computers of two hospitals being built in Wuhan, because there are live streams that allow them to watch it being built in real time. And this has suddenly become a huge fascination with people all over China.
And have you seen it?
I have, yes. It's you can watch it not only if you're based in China, but also on international platforms like YouTube that are blocked within the country. So people from all over the world are actually watching live streams of these two hospitals being built.
And what are you seeing?
Not a lot, because a lot of construction, a lot of vehicles travelling around. But people have really, because this is all they have to do, they're actually getting quite attached to this coverage, and they're creating nicknames for a lot of the construction vehicles, like the forklift trucks and the cement mixers. And they're creating groups within China to show their support towards certain vehicles, which ones they like and which ones they don't like.
And what kind of names are they coming up with?
We've got things like a cement mixer called the Big White Rabbit because it's white. Another one called the Cement King. A lot of people really like forklift trucks for some reason. They see them as the little heroes in all of this. So there's lots of nicknames for them. They're named after ancient emperors, or a lot of nicknames because of their colours. So there's the there's a large flatbed truck that's known as Brother Red Bull, and he's a favourite.
And they're all on, what, Weibo, the equivalent of Twitter, talking about it?
Yes, and not only Weibo, also on WeChat, which is China's version of WhatsApp. So there are dedicated groups to this. Hundreds of thousands of people all talking about these construction vehicles.
Kerry Allen. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.